This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Well, we go from that early CD of the saxophonist John Ellis to a conversation today with John Ellis by phone. You're in New Orleans, John?
I am indeed.
And you're at a jazz festival. How appropriate.
I know. It's amazing down here.
What's happening?
Well, today Sonny Rollins is playing, so you'll be happy to know that I'm missing Sonny Rollins in order to talk to you guys. But, no, it's beautiful. It's hot. I got a chance to hear Ellis Marsalis' set, and he was one of my really important mentors. It's always great to see him out there.
And did you record with Marsalis?
I made a recording that he was on as well. I never recorded on an album under his name, but we were both sidemen on a record of a friend of mine named Jason Stewart's. And ironically, I'm at Jason Stewart's mom's house today because she was the one that was kind enough to lend me her landline.
So we have a good sound for our conversation. Thanks so very much for making the extra effort. I know I know how hard it was to do that, but thank you for helping us with this little interview today.
My pleasure, my pleasure.
Now, let me play for our listeners a bit more of the cut that we've used now for 12 years on Keeping the Faith of your piece from your earliest CD, Language of Love. This is a piece called Grace. And before we hear it, what made you, this is a composition you wrote, what made you call it Grace?
Well, it's fitting because it's Mother's Day today. My mother's name is Grace, and her mother's name was also Grace. And my father is a Presbyterian minister, so I grew up in the church with a consideration of grace. So it really sort of had to do with all of those things, kind of a connectivity of my father and the church, and then, of course, my mom and her and my grandmother, both being named Grace.
Well, on Mother's Day, let's listen to a little bit more of it. We won't listen to the whole piece because I want to get to the interview, but let's let our listeners hear a bit more than they usually hear at the start and the finish of Keeping the Faith. That Fade Away, Grace from Language of Love, a 1996 recording and CD by John Ellis, tenor saxophone. John, your most recent CD, Puppet Mischief, has just had a phenomenal reception all over this country and, in fact, around the world. I was reading some of the reviews again this afternoon, and from Downbeat to the New York Times to Philadelphia, just all sorts of places have celebrated this. Let me just read a couple of these from Downbeat. A series of highly narrative original compositions that conjure up image of carnival grounds and seem to tell the stories of the offbeat characters who inhabit them. As in any good narrative, the lighthearted moments here are finally played out by their more dramatic counterpoints. That was from Downbeat, and from the New York Times, an irresistible new album, Puppet Mischief. The saxophonist John Ellis advances a flexible approach to post-bop, rooted in the groove of New Orleans. And I'll just read one later one. Puppet Mischief layers in John's New Orleans music influence with his childhood experiences of carnivals and state fairs and clowns to create an assemblage of music that will have you smiling, laughing, and from time to time scratching your head. A fun-filled, frantic, exciting, and rewarding day under the big top with John Ellis and Double Wide. Those are not the kind of descriptions that one associates with contemporary jazz. What led you into this? We're going to hear a cut from this, from the title cut, just a minute. But what led you into thinking about all these kind of things?
Well, I started a band a few years ago. This is Puppet Mischief is our second record, a band called Double Wide, and built it in many ways around the idea of having a band with the sousaphone playing the bass function, and particularly around the sousaphone playing of my friend Matt Perrine. And it's sort of, he's a really exceptional musician, a really unusual sousaphone player, one of the best I've ever played with. And so he allowed me to write and sort of imagine the kind of music that I couldn't really do without him. And there's an organ in the band, and you guys will hear when you hear the cut, there's trombone on this one, and there's also harmonica. I think a lot about sonic texture, so having the sousaphone affected a lot of things, but all the sounds of the instruments, the color of the instruments, helps me to think about the kind of picture I'm trying to paint. And I think it also does help me move away from something that's people associate with a traditional jazz sound. And then I love storytelling. I love that they describe that as narrative, just because that's a big part of what I think about. I like the idea that music can tell a story. Even though music is always very poetic and very abstract, ultimately it doesn't tell a linear story in the way that language might. But I like thinking of images, I like thinking of characters, and I loved going to the state fair as a kid. I loved the smell of the state fair. I still remember the excitement of all those rides, like seeing all the spinning and the lights. And it's fun to reflect on that and see if music might take you on a little bit of that journey. So I think the combination of the instruments and the sort of memories together sort of led me to some of that stuff. But
well, let's jump immediately from 1996 to the CD that came out last year, Puppet Mischief, 2010, John Ellis and Double Wide, and this is the title cut. fade out a bit from that at that point. Puppet Mischief, part of Puppet Mischief from the CD of that same title with John Ellis, and Double Wide from 2010. John, I'm sitting here looking at a poster that my son gave me for Christmas of that album. When you played in Philadelphia, he picked up a copy and sent it to me, brought it to me. And it's fun to be looking at that fun poster while listening to that very infectious music that brings up the images of a carnival. Tell us about how you compose for jazz. So much of jazz, of course, is still improvisation. Tell me how you work with these other musicians after you have an idea for a piece.
Well, I love writing music for people, for specific people. So it's nice to have people in mind and to think about their personalities and what I like hearing them do. So I spent some time thinking about that. It's nice to have this particular band, to have it be a regular band so that I can write for these particular people. I think the trick with composing for jazz, as opposed to composing for something more classical, is that you want to come up with something that's strong and that inspires the musicians to improvise, something that is suggestive of a mood or suggestive of something that sends them off into a space where they can improvise with that in mind. And it's tricky because you don't want to overwrite. Sometimes if you write too much, then it sort of shuts down the improvisational part of it. But I think you also want to have enough there that it creates the right kind of launching point. So, I don't know, writing music is one of the things I really enjoy doing, and I feel like I'm always trying to learn different ways to do it, different avenues in.
Now, I was looking at your schedule on your very nice website, johnaxonellis.com. That Axon is spelled AXSON, and Ellis is ELLIS, johnaxonellis.com. And I was looking at where you've had a very busy April, and I see in May and June you're going to be spending part of the time in Spain. I see you're going to be with Sean Smith, Alan Ferber. I'm not sure how to pronounce Arimage.
Arimage, yeah, that's correct.
All right. At the Jazz Standard. You're going to be playing in several places around Spain. And I'm not sure, again, how to pronounce the quartet you're playing with.
Oh, that's Ignacio Berroa. Ignacio Berroa.
You've been traveling around the country really from very early in your musical career. When was the first time you went overseas to play?
That's a good question. I think the first time I went overseas, believe it or not, was when I was at the North Carolina School of the Arts. And I was actually trained as an oboist there when I was in high school. So in my 10th grade year, I was playing oboe at the North Carolina School of the Arts, and I was in the orchestra, and they took the orchestra overseas. And it's actually funny, during that experience, I kind of got a little insight to what it might feel like to be an orchestral oboe player, and kind of decided that it wasn't for me. So I sort of came back in a little bit of a crisis, trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and I was already becoming really interested in playing jazz, and it was that first experience of traveling overseas was as an oboist, and it kind of helped me decide that I didn't really want to do that. So
Ray Still of the Chicago Symphony and John Dew of here at the University of Illinois oboists, I'm sure are glad you went toward the saxophone and jazz.
The oboe is extremely difficult.
Oh, yes.
Extremely beautiful, but extremely difficult.
Right.
I feel like I made a wise decision.
Tell us a little bit about your experience with the North Carolina School of the Arts. You mentioned in your bio on your website that it was very important to you.
Well, it really changed my life. Without any exaggeration. I grew up in a town of 200 people called Cameron, North Carolina, and my parents are very worldly, very wonderful people, but I was still a very small town person with a really small town perspective. And it was the first time I started to meet people from all over, people with lots of different interests, people with lots of different backgrounds. And also just getting exposed to the idea of being having a professional life in the arts and what that might be like. And I think the most important thing that happened to me there was I met, after that first year where I played oboe, and I switched to saxophone for my second year there, and I met who became really my most important mentor, I would say, which is a saxophonist named James Holick. And he's one of those rare artists who is, I think, equally gifted as a performer and as a teacher. And he, I had the great fortune of basically being a beginner with him. I had made it far enough as an oboist that they sort of took me on as a project. They knew that I was willing to work. But I wasn't really, I hadn't really played the saxophone very much. This would have been when I was a junior in high school. And he was kind enough to take me on as kind of an experiment. And he, but to have a teacher of that level when you're kind of a beginner is something I think is very rare, and it really was just good luck. And, you know, I still have his voice in my head all the time, you know, pushing me to try to strive to play the saxophone better. He's really an amazing teacher in terms of just playing the instrument well, and then he's an incredible artist in terms of the way he thinks about music and interpretation. And certainly whenever I have the opportunity to teach saxophonist, I always think of the things that he taught me because they're so clear and so inspiring.
Now, that school encompasses what grades, what ages?
I think it's a very unusual school for the country. It's everything from even below high school, I guess junior high in the dance department, all the way through graduate studies. So it's a very wide range of ages, and you can get a master's degree from there, or you could be, you know, seventh grade. It just depends on what discipline you're studying. They have dance, they have drama, they have visual art, design and production, they have film school now, they have acting, obviously music. I think it's unusual school. Most of my friends who I know who have gone to performing arts schools, they're usually high schools, just performing arts high schools. If they went in high school, it was just for high school. But this one covers a lot.
Now, you did not finish college there. You went instead to New York, was it? Or I forget, perhaps New Orleans?
Yeah, both. Actually, you're right in both cases. I went to 1 year of college at the School of the Arts. My schooling is very complicated. I went to 1 year of college at the School of the Arts. But in many ways, it was just an extension of the studies that I started there. You sort of begin a curriculum, and then you carry it through. And it carried me into my first year of college. And then I transferred to the University of New Orleans, where I studied with Ellis Marsalis and Harold Batiste. And I was there for 1 year, and then I left for a few years, and then I ended up finishing at the New School in New York City.
We're talking with John Ellis with his some of his recent recordings with his band Double Wide. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs, but I'm happy to include others who might call in with a question or a comment. Let me give the phone numbers where you can do that. If you're listening and it's a long-distance call, punch in 1-800-222-9455 for a toll-free call. Again, that number is 1-800-222-9455. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area where WILL studio is, you may use a local line, 333-9455. So if you're within the 217 area code, punch in 333-9455. John, you mentioned on your website again, johnxandellis.com, that one of the things that you're impressed by is your ability to play with other people who have different take on contemporary music. Tell us some of the people you've played with.
Most of what I do is work as a sideman. I have 6 records of my own, but I also play with lots of people with lots of different styles of music. So let's see. Most recently, I've been playing some with a very well-known bass player named John Patitucci. He made a trio record with saxophone, bass, and drums that I did some of the gigs to promote that record. Let's see. I also play a lot with a bunch of my friends, my peers. There's three drummers that I recorded with recently. Jamire Williams, whose band is called Iramage, which is just his name backwards. Kendrick Scott and Otis Brown. All three fantastic young drummers that I have recently recorded with. Let's see. I play a lot with a bass player named Sean Smith. I must have been playing with Sean for nearly 10 years, and we finally made a record together. I play a lot with a bass player from Denmark, a woman named Anna Meta Iversen, and we have several albums together. She's a great composer. I don't know. I have a discography on my website that I would definitely encourage.
It's very extensive.
But it's fairly long. I mean, I must have recorded nearly 100 records.
And I heard you play live here in Champaign-Urbana with someone playing an 8-string guitar.
Yeah, Charlie Hunter. Yeah, really, probably the biggest touring opportunity that I had, the most long-lasting touring opportunity, was with Charlie Hunter. And actually, we just played together again after many years. I stopped playing with him in 2006, but we played in March in Colorado, and it was nice. He's a great friend. I spent about 5 years on the road with him, and saw a lot of the country that I hadn't seen, and learned a lot about music and a lot about what it's like to travel in a band throughout the U.S. and make music. I would say that was my most important long-lasting touring career.
Now, earlier this year, you were playing in Japan with a St. Louis singer named Aaron Bode. Is it Bode or Bode?
Bode, yeah.
Bode. And you mentioned that she's the daughter of a Lutheran pastor, and you say she has the poise that clearly comes from performing from an early age. And you mentioned that you loved Mr. Rogers who, from television, and you say Aaron Bode has his brand of genuine goodness and earnestness, you might say. And you go on to your website to say, earnestness requires great courage. God forbid we look corny somehow. And it's a quality that you find more and more attracted to the older you get. You say, tell me about earnestness.
Well, I think, you know, being the son of a Presbyterian minister, and the older I get, really coming to appreciate Mr. Rogers in a real authentic way. I've noticed that when I talk about Mr. Rogers, by the way, Mr. Rogers was a great songwriter too, and all those songs associated with the show were songs that he wrote. He had a great piano player named Johnny Costa that was in the band and with him the whole time, accompanying him. You know, every time he came and sang "It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood," the band was accompanying him live. And they were great jazz musicians from Pittsburgh. But I've done a lot of reflection on Mr. Rogers. He was an ordained Presbyterian minister himself. I don't know how many people realize that, but the thing about being earnest, sort of being good in that way, is that it people don't really seem to trust it. I mean, when I tell people that I'm a fan of Mr. Rogers, a lot of times it seems like they think that it's an ironic joke of some kind, because you know, there's this sort of a thing. There's also a lot of urban legends about Mr. Rogers, you know, that he was a Navy SEAL and that he wore sweaters because he had tattoos and, you know, all these things. That it's almost like because he was actually so genuinely good, people don't believe it, which is kind of fascinating to me. But I've just been inspired by that because it seems like my generation, and I think this is sort of overall, but you certainly see it in music too. Tendency to elevate a sort of cleverness or sort of an ironic detachment or a cleverness. And I think sometimes the reason that people shoot for that is because it's a little bit safer. If you're being clever and being detached, then you know you're not really putting your heart out there. And there's something about being earnest that it's great. It makes you quite vulnerable. It's a great vulnerability, and people can accuse you of corniness. So Mr. Rogers has always been kind of certainly in recent years has really been a hero of mine, in the sense that he was, I find him to be a person of great courage in terms of how authentic and earnest he was all the time. And there's a lot of things to watch, actually. He's, He was a guest on the Johnny Carson show when it was being guest hosted by Joan Rivers. That's a really interesting thing to
combination.
Watch.
Combination, wow.
To watch how she responded to him, and sort of, she turned into like a small child. And, you know, he also did some very courageous, he testified in front of the Senate and got some funding for public television, and that's on YouTube. If you search for Mr. Rogers and testifying in front of the Senate, and you see how he spoke at his testimony, and it's kind of amazing to witness something like that.
Let's play another cut from your Puppet Mischief CD that perhaps is earnest. Let's listen to Chorale. From Puppet Mischief, John Ellis and Double Wide, a 2010 CD. We're about halfway through our program today, Keeping the Faith, here on WILL. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, at 580 AM. And if you have an HD radio, you can also hear us at 90.9 FM, HD3. And, of course, it can be heard live also at will.illinois.edu/am. And our programs, of course, are archived. And in a week or so, this program will be available at that same website, will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. Take the G out of keeping. We're very informal here. And you can hear these programs at your convenience via your computer or various other electronic devices. John, we'll be getting back to you in just a moment. Let me just take a second or two to let listeners know what's coming up in the weeks ahead. Next week, the Social Justice Committee of Urbana High School here in Illinois. The English teacher, Ellen Dahlke, will be our guest. We'll, along with two students, Alice Woodland and Shaniqua Durgan, talking about some of the very interesting activities of that Social Justice Committee of a local high school. Later in May, we'll be talking with Professor John Esposito on the 29th, who is the director of the Georgetown University Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. That's in Washington, D.C., of course. Professor Esposito recently gave a very important lecture here at the University of Illinois and is the author of a recent book called The Challenge of Pluralism in the 21st Century, where he dealt with the whole issue of Islamophobia. And our guest host for that interview will be Professor Don Nolan. I'll be traveling on the 29th of May. So those are some of the people coming up ahead on Keeping the Faith. And again, if you've missed part of this interview, some of the wonderful music by John Ellis, and in this case, Double Wide, you can hear it in its entirety at your convenience in a week or so. I want to thank the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign for its continued support for Keeping the Faith. this week and next week, they will be collecting leftover things as students move out from the university, things that ordinarily might get thrown in a dumpster. They call this collection Dump and Run. Instead of putting it in a dumpster, drop it off at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street, the corner of Wright and Chalmers, right across the street from Lincoln Hall and the Quadrangle. All sorts of things, furniture, working computer equipment, televisions, radios, anything like that that's still in good working order, clothes, music, videos, anything that other people might like, because, of course, the University of Hawaii saves all these things from this 2 weeks of collection in huge semi-trailer trucks and then bring them out over at the Stock Pavilion next fall when new students arrive, and particularly international students love going to the big dump and run sale. It helps make money for the University Y, and students and others buy things very inexpensively. And of course, it keeps things out of the trash, out of the trash stream. So recycle, reuse, take things to dump and run. Anybody in the community can do this. It starts, as I say, tomorrow. Goes all week, Monday through Saturday, the 9th through the 14th of May, and then again next week, Monday through Friday, the 16th through the 20th. It's available from 9 to 4 p.m., and Thursdays are open late till 7. So for 2 weeks, dump and run at the University Y. If you have questions, call 217-337-1500 to get more information. Or you could just pull into the back of the Y, and there'll be students and other volunteers there to help you unload your car, truck, whatever you've got, van, with good usable items. Things for the kitchen, things for apartments, dorm rooms for students particularly. But there are all kinds of things that are donated, and practically everything that's donated gets sold in the fall. So it's a great recycling effort. Well, let's get back to our conversation with John Ellis. And if there are listeners who'd like to call in, please do. The numbers again in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, long distance 1-800-222-9455. And John, don't have hurt feelings if people don't call, because most in fact are just happy to listen and hear your music and your comments about it. Let's talk about some of your music before Double Wide. You mentioned some of it. I'd like to play something from the title cut from "Dance Like There's No Tomorrow." Tell us a little bit about that album.
Well, yeah, that was the first record that was Double Wide.
Yeah.
So that record was
Excuse me, John, we're having a little trouble with your phone connection. The sound isn't as... It was very good before, but it's very garbled right now.
Garbled? Okay. Is that better?
Let's try it again, yes.
That's better?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, yeah. Double Wide, that was my very first Double Wide record, Dance Like There's No Tomorrow. And I was considering the sound of the musical, the organ, the drums, and the saxophone together. And I brought these guys up from New Orleans to New York, and we had actually never played a gig at all. And I took the great risk of hoping that this sound would work, and we would go in the studio to record it. And things actually went kind of amazing as well. We were all kind of discovering the sound and this music together.
John, we are still having problems with the sound of the telephone connection. So what I'm going to do is ask you to hang up, and we'll call you again. And
okay.
In the meantime, we'll play that cut, and so you may hear it when you come back. I'm sorry. Let's see. I'm getting a message from our technical director, Kyle Crow. Let's see if I'm doing this right. Yeah, we're going to play the cut number 9, Kyle, Dance Like There's No Tomorrow, like we had talked about. And in the meantime, John, you hang up, and we'll call you back.
Okay, well.
Thanks. Thank you. Again, part of Dance Like There's No Tomorrow from the CD of that same name. That was, what, 2008, John?
That sounds right. Sounds right.
Okay. The sound still isn't great, but let's try it a little bit longer, and we may have to try again. When you were in New York doing this, this was the first time this combination had been together. And tell our listeners again what instruments we're hearing in this recording.
Well, that's a sousaphone playing the bass, which is the marching tuba that John Philip Sousa invented.
The kind that wraps around the player's head and the big bell that comes out of the top, right?
Exactly right, exactly right. It looks like something from the circus, or you see it at the halftime shows all the time at the football game. So, that's Matt Perrine playing the sousaphone, and then that's Gary Versace playing the organ, and Jason Marsalis playing drums. And then, of course, I'm playing tenor saxophone.
We're still not getting the best sound. I'm going to see if maybe we could try your cell phone. We have that number as well. Let's see if that maybe is a better sound. In the meantime, let's listen to Little Giggles from an earlier recording. This is the CD By a Thread. It's Little Giggles. Thank you. We're back on Keeping the Faith. We're trying still to make a connection with John Ellis, and we're hoping that the sound quality is a bit better here. We're working on that. Let me just remind people, John Ellis is a saxophone player whose music begins and ends Keeping the Faith and has for the last 12 years. We've been playing something from his very first CD in 1996 called Grace. This program began in 1999, and we've been playing that ever since. I remember when we first started, it caused a bit of controversy. There wasn't all that much jazz played on this AM NPR regional station as intros and so forth. But I thought it was a very appropriate pick, and I think it has worn well with people. John, I think we have you back on the phone.
Yes, I think so.
Oh, great. You're sounding fine. Good. We just listened to Little Giggles from your 2006 By a Thread. Tell us who was involved in that recording.
That was a bass player named Reuben Rogers and a drummer named Terrion Gully, a guitar player named Mike Moreno, and a piano player named Aaron Goldberg. That was the second record that I did for Hyena Records, and it was the last record that I did before Double Wide.
It's interesting that these days a musician has their whole history available for people to hear. Now, when you listen to things you did 10, 12 years ago, do you say, gee, why did I do it that way, or do you still enjoy it?
For the most part, I enjoy it. I mean, I honestly don't really listen that much to my stuff, my earlier stuff or my more current stuff. You know, I'm mostly listening to records by other people, but it's really great. I mean, there was a record called Roots, Branches, and Leaves that, was a record I put out on Fresh Sound. It was the very next record I did after, Language of Love. And I hadn't heard that record in more than 10 years, and someone put it on for me, and it was really nice, actually.
Tell us about your most recent project with a playwright, Andy Braggin.
Mm-hmm. Well, for the last couple of years, I've been working with Andy. He's a good friend of mine. We actually used to live in the same house, and this was the third collaboration that we've done together, and this one is was called Mobro. It was about the journey of the Mobro 4000, which sailed in 1987. It was a barge filled with garbage that sailed from New York City. Originally, it was the garbage was bought by a man in North Carolina who wanted to start a methane farm. And the citizens of North Carolina decided maybe they didn't want to have the garbage from New York City to come down to their state and be buried in the ground. And so they organized against it and basically rejected this garbage, and that sort of began this incredible journey where there was this boat of this garbage barge that was traveling around with no home, kind of. And it was a kind of a beginning of a global awareness about trash, about waste, about the environment. It's sort of around that time that there was some medical waste that was came up onto the shores in New Jersey, and it was the beginning of what they called NIMBY, which was the Not In My Backyard.
But it was just kind of, we thought it was a really interesting story because it touched on all these things. It kind of touched on immigration, it touched on trash, it touched on, you know, sort of global warming and general sense of anxiety about these things. And it also happened to be that this garbage barge went to a bunch of cities that have been really important for me. You know, it started in New York City, it went to North Carolina, it went to New Orleans, all on the same journey. So it just seems like there was a lot of room for us to find some way to interpret it. So he and I came up with kind of a superstructure, and we wrote this very long piece, actually. It ended up being the longest thing I've ever written that was conceived as one piece, which it's more than an hour and a half, a little more than an hour and a half long, with a bunch of singing. We had four singers and four brass, two guitars, bass and drums. So it was really fun. It's one of the most exciting things I've done.
Now you've done other collaborations with Andy. Tell us about them.
The most previous one, I really think we've done two that I really feel really, really great about. So this one that we just recently did called Mulbrew, and then the most previous one, the one just before that, was called The Ice Siren. And that was, I had an idea to try to work with strings, to try to learn how to write more for strings. So that was for string quartet, tuba, vibraphone, guitar, and percussion. And it had two singers. That was with Gretchen Parlato and Miles Griffith. And we sort of told this twisted love story. It was basically about a guy who's visiting his deceased lover's tomb and gets kind of pulled, you know, it's a very fantastical story, but he hears a voice and he gets pulled down into the crypt, and there's a kind of fantastical world inside of there, and it sort of hears her voice, and it's sort of like, interestingly, kind of haunting and humorous, I guess, is what we ended up doing. But that one turned out really great, too, actually. And the one we did before that was our first attempt at dreamscapes, where he wrote these kind of 12-line dream-influenced poems, and I tried to respond to them with music. And we were finding our way. I didn't feel as good about how dreamscapes turned out, but maybe we'll revisit. I think conceptually it was strong, but the execution wasn't so great.
Now, where have these been performed?
All of them were performed at the Jazz Gallery, which is a not-for-profit sort of temple of jazz in New York City. It's a fantastic place. It's a lot of volunteers, and it's very unusual in the sense that it's, you know, they're not trying to make their money by selling drinks. They don't even sell drinks. Most of their funding is from membership, in the same way that public radio has membership, and also from grants.
Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, of course. And I think it's kind of valuable in the same way. I mean, I think that, you know, as a public radio, as listener-supported, this is kind of listener-supported jazz venue, which is, I think, very unusual and allows them to do some more adventurous kind of programming. It allows them to try to present new artists that they think are important but still need to develop. And I've been very fortunate to have such a long relationship with them and to be able to debut these pieces there.
Folks unable to see the live performance, have they been recorded in any way? Are they on YouTube or something?
The Ice Siren is basically all on YouTube, cut up into smaller pieces. But if you search for the Ice Siren, S-I-R-E-N, kind of like siren as in a mermaid, you can find it. And then the new one is really brand new. We did it last weekend. So we have it well documented. It was recorded live, and it was also videotaped. But we haven't put it up anywhere yet.
How do you, as a musician trying to make a living as a performer and someone who records their own music, what do you think about people being able to get all this stuff free, either on YouTube or somewhere else?
Well, it's really complicated. That's a complicated question. The music business is in a state of transition, but I think anyone who's studied the music business knows that it's been in sort of a perpetual state of transition from the beginning. So the move to the digital format is only one of many moves that have happened over the years, and I think that the obvious advantage of having access to YouTube and access to the internet in the way that artists do is that you have for many people to hear your music. the disadvantage is that there's a it brings up a lot of questions about intellectual property. It does, in some ways, can possibly make it more difficult to get paid for certain things, but it can also make it easier if you're able to build an audience. I think that if you ask 100 musicians, you probably might get 100 different perspectives as to how they feel about it. For me, I think some things it's made much easier for me, and some things I think it's made more difficult. Being able to reach everyone is fantastic, but also everyone is also being able to reach everyone. So you have a little bit of a problem of saturation and people not being able to filter through all of the information in order to find what it is that they want, or just to sort of get your voice out there while everyone is shouting can be kind of difficult sometimes.
The fairest way, of course, to get recordings by John Ellis is to go to his website, John Axson, AXSON, John Axson Ellis, ELLIS.com. When I was looking for your name on things where you can download music, I noticed there are at least two other John Ellis's who have recordings of various type of music. One, I think, is Irish, and I forget who the other one is. But that does complicate it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I got a call or an email from someone who was trying to book me actually at a festival in South Africa, and took a minute to realize that they were actually looking for the South African guy named John Ellis who recently put out a record. So, yeah, I mean, I guess there was a time when I was in high school I thought about starting to go by my middle name, Axon, and maybe I should have done that. That might have made my life easier. But I don't have it quite as difficult as Avishai Cohen, because there's two fantastic jazz musicians and they're both named Avishai Cohen. I know that's been confusing for both of them.
Well, we're talking with the tenor saxophonist John Ellis, and we're about out of time. But John, I want to thank you very much for taking time away from the New Orleans Jazz Festival that you're attending right now and talking with us on Keeping the Faith. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with high school teacher Ellen Dahlke from Urbana High School, where she teaches English, and two students from the Social Justice Committee, Ellis Woodland and Shaniqua Durgan. Later in May, on the 29th, we'll be talking with Professor John Esposito, who is director of the Georgetown University Center for Muslim Christian Understanding in Washington, D.C., the author of the recent book, The Challenge of Pluralism in the 21st Century, where he deals particularly with Islamophobia, the fear and hatred of practitioners of Islam. It should be a very interesting discussion. I'll be traveling that day, and Professor Don Nolan from Parkland College will be conducting that interview. Let me mention again, please, the collections at the University YMCA. For those of you within driving distance of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, Dump and Run collection happens these next 2 weeks, May 9 through 14 and May 16 through 20. That's Monday through Saturday this week and Monday through Friday the following week from 9 to 4 p.m. at the University YMCA. On the campus of the University of Illinois, 1001 South Wright Street, you may take all manner of things that are still good and might be usable for students and others at the big sale next fall. You may deliver these things to the Y, and they're open on Thursday nights till 7 to make it easier for those who have work days. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works, Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge and American Concierge magazines. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and a business and shopping guide. Concierge magazines are distributed throughout Central Illinois and always present the Champaign-Urbana and Bloomington-Normal areas at their best.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.